From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The World Health Organization is now calling the spread of COVID-19 a global pandemic. And here in the U.S., the Federal Aviation Administration said today that it will waive minimum flight requirements at some airports through May, throwing a lifeline to airlines that have seen a drop-off in travel demand due to the outbreak. Airlines can lose their slots at crowded airports if they don't use them, and many in the industry had been calling on the FAA to waive that requirement. One of them is Robin Hayes, CEO of JetBlue, who joins me now. And Robin, I know you were hoping for that change because business is way down for JetBlue and other carriers. How bad is it?
You know, I would say we're in the middle of a very significant impact. Some would say devastating impact to the airline industry. We really see these sorts of events every 10 years or so. I mean, for me, 9/11 is the closest to what we're seeing now. That was a very sort of fear-driven event. There were lots of concerns just after 9/11 about flying. And we're really seeing the same now with the coronavirus.
How would you quantify it? I mean, could you tell us how many flights you've had to cancel? You know, how much you've seen revenues go down?
Sure. So, you know, again, let me compare it to 9/11. In 9/11, we saw the U.S. airline industry fall about 30% from just before to just after that tragic event. We're seeing bookings come off to an even greater extent.
How long are you prepared for it to go on?
Well, we're planning this to go on for a very significant period of time. The good news for JetBlue is that we have a very strong balance sheet. We've been preparing 10 years for this event, and we're acting very quickly to cut capacity and reduce costs so we can weather this. No one really knows how long this will last. You know, some people will point to China and say the airline industry has started to recover. But after 9/11, there was it was 2 years before you would say the industry was back to where it was before 9/11. So we're able and willing to sit this out for a very long period of time, and we're willing to do what it takes to make sure JetBlue can come through this successfully.
Well, and I've already heard you say that in some ways it's worse than 9/11. And as you know, at that time, the federal government bailed out the airlines, offering billions of dollars. Do you think that will be necessary this time? Do you want the help from the federal government?
The industry here in the U.S. is in a very different place to where it was even 10 years ago, pre the financial crisis. It's pretty healthy. We've all built stronger balance sheets. We've all got good liquidity. And so I think the economic backdrop for airlines is very different. Airlines are much more able to withstand something like this than they were 10 years ago.
What are you doing to accommodate your flight crew? They are exposed to people more than anybody else on those airplanes.
Sure. So first of all, that's a very important question. You know, our number one priority is the safety and security of both our crew members and our customers. So our crew members are trained to handle customers when they get sick. We have protective equipment on board. We've also changed our service routines to remove some of the contact points. So, for example, we've suspended hot towel service. And also, we are enabling our in-flight crews to wear gloves if that's something they would like to do. And I would also say that when we think about flying, you know, we really want people to think about it as safe as anything else you do on your in your day-to-day life. So going to the grocery store, going to the library, grabbing a coffee. JetBlue is deep cleaning our airplanes overnight. We're sanitizing them. We're disinfecting them. We have disinfectant wipes on the airplane for customers if they want to wipe down their own seats. And the air systems in the airplanes, I think there's a lot of misconceptions about this, but we use hospital-grade filtering systems on airplanes. The air in a cabin is recirculated every 3 minutes, and it flows from top to bottom. There's not really any lateral movement on an airplane of the air. And so the other thing I'd say is if you're not feeling well, don't fly. I mean, JetBlue is offering free changes and cancellations to customers at the moment. So take advantage of that. And if you can, delay your trip.
What do you think this could potentially do to the airline industry? If we're still struggling a year from now, do you expect either bankruptcies or reshuffling, mergers, that sort of thing to kick in?
Well, I think the U.S. industry is probably about the strongest in the world at the moment. So I think the U.S. industry is best equipped to survive. You know, I think that you look at a number of airlines in Asia and Europe that were already struggling to get by. They were already very highly leveraged. I think it's going to be a real challenge for them, and many of them may not last even a year. We've already seen one UK-based airline go into bankruptcy last week, and I think there'll be others to follow in the near future, actually.
That's Robin Hayes, CEO of JetBlue. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Well, the epicenter of the coronavirus is the Chinese city of Wuhan, which has been locked down for weeks. But yesterday, President Xi Jinping visited and said there has been a promising turn in containment there. NPR's Beijing correspondent Emily Feng joins us now. Hi, Emily.
Hey, Jeremy.
So you're in Beijing, but what are you hearing about whether life is returning to normal in Wuhan?
It's still in complete shutdown. Officials are debating right now about whether to let people travel again and return to work. But you can understand that officials are still really wary of allowing reinfections or a surge of new cases to happen. And so Hubei province, where Wuhan is located, is still very much under quarantine, but the rest of China is slowly returning back to work.
Well, and we are seeing the numbers of new cases fall dramatically in China. Is it clear why that is?
It's because of the stringent quarantine and social distancing measures that China has taken. There was a recent paper that was published yesterday from researchers both from the U.S. and from China that said these quarantine measures work, albeit at a very high cost to the economy, to civil liberties. And in fact, they pointed out one thing that might be new and also effective, which are these new quarantine centers that China built over a course of several weeks to put patients with mild or suspected symptoms of the coronavirus, because a major source of transmission was these people are going home and infecting their family members.
Emily, in this country, there is a lot of anger about people not being able to get tests if they want. If you want a test for coronavirus in China, is it hard to get it?
At the very beginning of the outbreak, particularly in the epicenter in Hubei province, it was very difficult to get tests. And there were multiple private companies that were putting forth these tests, which were not entirely accurate. You saw a lot of false negatives. So the testing issue is something that's universal.
Emily, what about your life in Beijing on a daily basis? What is it like there now?
Honestly, I cannot remember what life was like before the outbreak. Things are still really quiet. Beijing is in a unique place because it was a first-tier city, you know, a major cosmopolitan center that was never completely sealed off, in part because it's a seat of government in China. But it's also where a lot of international travelers come in. And so the fear now in Beijing is there will be imported cases from Japan, Korea, even the U.S., which was reported yesterday. So Beijing is now tightening its quarantine measures, while the rest of the country, with the exception of Hubei, are loosening them. Just yesterday said there's foreigners should not travel. And then today they announced that anyone who comes from abroad, comes back to Beijing, has to self-quarantine for 2 weeks.
You know, one of the things that you almost never see in the press when it comes to stories about China and China's government is criticism from people in China. But in this case, we have seen some of that. How do people feel about how the government has handled this?
It's complicated. There has been a lot of criticism, and interestingly enough, some of that criticism has been allowed to survive publicly. The reason for that is a lot of the frustration is with how local officials on the ground bungled the initial approach to containing the outbreak and then tried to cover up the illness. But now the central government has come in and imposed these very rigorous, very, in many people's eyes, responsible quarantine measures. And so the anger is directed not at top leaders like Xi Jinping, but at people in Wuhan and Hubei province who have been fired.
Do you think that this experience is going to make China and China's government more transparent going forward?
No, I don't think so. And it might end up being a PR win for the Chinese Communist Party. At the beginning, people were saying this might be an incredible embarrassment because they haven't been able to contain this virus. But as countries like the U.S. and Italy struggle with how to test and take care of their own patients, China has been saying we've done a great job with quarantine measures because of our unique centralized authoritarian model of governance, and it could be a PR win for them.
And what about surveillance? How is the government tracking people in their daily lives to find out travel history and whether they're sick?
The primary way is through this new app that translates roughly to health codes in English. And it began in one province first. You enter in your ID number, some other personal details, and it'll spit back at you a colored code to indicate your risk of infection. And then you have to show and scan that wherever you go to, say, enter a grocery store or your office. You know, this could be a temporary fad, or it could be laying the groundwork for a much more enduring system of surveillance.
Emily, one more thing. You know, you're kind of a glimpse into our possible future in China, because the U.S. is way behind China in terms of its experience with the coronavirus. What does it feel like for you there, watching now what's happening in the United States?
It's incredibly weird, because it's the sense of deja vu, the same mistakes that you saw the local and provincial governments in Hubei province making, not being able to get test kits or limiting who could get tested at the very beginning, and then putting in travel restrictions or even full-out quarantines of places that started to show networks of transmission. All of that's not being played out in Italy and the U.S., and that's really heartbreaking to watch.
That is NPR's Beijing correspondent Emily Feng. Emily, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Hi, I'm Manoush Zomorodi, and I am the new host of NPR's TED Radio Hour. I am so excited because we are working on a bunch of new, amazing episodes. We're exploring big ideas about reinvention, making amends, and the psychological effects of climate change. Our first show drops March 13th. Please join me.
Senator Bernie Sanders is staying in the race. He made the announcement today after another disappointing performance in yesterday's primaries. And he said he'd be at Sunday night's debate against Joe Biden in Arizona.
Donald Trump must be defeated, and I will do everything in my power to make that happen. On Sunday night, in the first one-on-one debate of this campaign, the American people will have the opportunity to see which candidate is best positioned to accomplish that goal.
Joe Biden won at least four states yesterday, including the big prize of Michigan, which Bernie Sanders won 4 years ago. Biden won last night by more than 15 points. Speaking to his supporters in Philadelphia, Biden sounded very much like the presumptive Democratic Party nominee.
And I want to thank Bernie Sanders and his supporters for their tireless energy and their passion. We share a common goal, and together we'll defeat Donald Trump. We'll defeat him together.
Let's bring in our political strategist, Jamal Simmons, Democrat. Hi, Jamal.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. And Matt Mikowiak, Republican. Hi, Matt.
Hey there.
And I just want to start by saying that it was 11 days ago Joe Biden had not won a single primary or caucus in his entire life. And now here we are, very different situation. Jamal, what did you make of what Bernie Sanders said today?
Well, first of all, America is an amazing place.
Right? Anything can happen.
Anything can happen. That's why they play the game on Tuesdays. So I think what's happening with Bernie Sanders is, first of all, he is right in this respect. He has set the pace for the Democratic Party in terms of policy. And I think Democrats need to be thankful to him for that, whether it's Medicare for all or free college tuition or even some of the Green New Deal stuff that AOC promotes. Even though Democrats won't do those things the way he wants to do it, everybody's either Bernie dark blue or Bernie light blue, but some version of that is on the table. So Democrats owe Bernie Sanders a debt of gratitude for that. The problem for Sanders has always been they couldn't decide how much they were fighting Donald Trump and how much they were fighting 30 or 25 or 30% of the Democratic Party, which they like to call the establishment, which I think is really just regular everyday Democrats who tend to put, you know, they put Nancy Pelosi in the Speaker's chair twice and Bill Clinton in the White House twice and Barack Obama twice. Those are the people that it seemed like Bernie Sanders was running against. And you can't run against both the Republicans and some part of the Democratic Party.
You know, there are many Democrats who are probably upset about Bernie Sanders saying today that he's going to stay in the race. One of them is probably South Carolina Congressman James Clyburn, who's supporting Biden and spoke to NPR about it last night. Listen.
I think it is time for us to shut this primary down. It's time for us to cancel the rest of these debates because you don't do anything but get yourself in trouble if you continue this contest when it's obvious that the numbers will not shake out for you.
I'm going to put this to you, Matt. As somebody watching as a Republican, do you think Bernie staying in the race hurts Biden in the general election?
Well, it prevents the Democratic Party from fully unifying behind Biden, and it really does that more with the progressives. I mean, the establishment of the party, the elected officials all across the country have started to unify behind him, believing he's a stronger nominee and believing that he's going to be the nominee. You know, if you look at the math coming out of last night, going into last night, I think Biden needed something like 54% of the delegates to clinch a majority on the first ballot. After last night, he now needs 50.6%, and Bernie needs 56% of the delegates to get to a majority. So I do think mathematically it's still in a range where if something were to happen, it could perhaps go in either direction, or you could have no majority on the first ballot. But I think this thing may be over very quickly when Ohio and Florida and Illinois and other states likely go for Biden. It's hard to see how Bernie changes this race without just some shocking development in the debate on Sunday night. But look, Biden hasn't had a one-to-one debate in a while. And Bernie, in the press conference he just finished, made clear he is going to try to hold Biden accountable on policy ideas. And so, yes, to the extent that the Democratic Party and the progressive left do not unify behind Biden and that gets delayed, it does give Trump and the Republicans a chance to continue basically running a general election campaign with a head start.
Matt, after—
You know, it's helpful to think about it this way. Bernie Sanders is riding a tiger, right? This tiger of progressive activism, and they go after people hard online. They go after people on these shows. And I think the question is, can he— if he doesn't end this campaign in the right way, that tiger might turn around and bite Bernie too. He's got to find a way to end this campaign that his people feel somewhat justified and okay, so that then he can turn that attention towards something more productive.
Matt, can you take a little deeper look at what happened in Michigan last night? Joe Biden did very well, much better than Hillary Clinton did in Michigan in 2016. Any concern that Trump doesn't stack up as well against Biden in Michigan, a key state in the general election?
I don't think that primary vote performance is much of a predictor for a general election. You don't have general election voters paying attention yet. You haven't had the campaign start in the general election yet, where the candidates are going after each other, putting their plans out there, drawing contrasts, performing, being covered by media, being vetted. So I don't know that it really means that much. One of the things I think that did become clear last night is just how much Bernie's strength last time, 4 years ago, was as much an anti-Hillary vote as it was a pro-Bernie vote. And that is simply not the case now, right? There just isn't the level of negativity and animosity towards Biden as a candidate and certainly as a person, even within the Democratic primary electorate, but to say nothing of the broader electorate. So, this election, I think you can boil it down to Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania in the fall. If Trump wins two of those three, he's going to get reelected. The Democrats are going to try to expand the map with Arizona and Georgia, and the Republicans are going to try to expand the map with New Hampshire and maybe the one delegate in Maine and maybe Minnesota. But everyone tries to expand the map. Generally, I think this is going to be the smallest battleground state map in a generation. It's going to come down to the Midwest and to the white working class voter that Trump narrowly was able to win in those states in 2016. We'll see whether they ultimately want to pull the lever for Biden or whether they want to stick with Trump based on the rising wages that they've been seeing over the last few years.
Jamal, what are you worried about, if Biden is the nominee? What are you worried about weaknesses in his campaign? You may have seen the hashtag that's sort of been percolating up on social media, Biden's cognitive decline. Some of that's coming from Bernie Sanders supporters. How worried are you about that and where his weaknesses are in this race?
Well, it sounds like a bunch of that's coming from the Republican side of the digital house.
They're going to use it
fanned
too.
By some fanned by some foreign operators and picked up by some Democrats who are playing along. Listen, I there is a caution flag on the track for Joe Biden that all Democrats, if he becomes a nominee, need to pay attention to. The young people who are excited about Bernie. You've got to look at Joe Biden a little bit like the incumbent in this race. And Bernie Sanders is a little bit like he's the insurgent candidate that's running against him, the Pat Buchanan running against George H.W. Bush way back when in the 1990s. Like, you've got to pay attention to that group of voters that Bernie Sanders is not doing well with. Hillary Clinton didn't pay enough attention to Bernie's voters, didn't find policy issues that they could really rally around. Bernie Sanders maybe didn't do enough to get them excited. And that spells part of the problem that she faced in the fall. That's the place where the primary campaign does tell you. It tells you where the establishment candidate or the winner's soft spots are. And those soft spots need to be tended to by that winner.
Matt, when it comes to soft spots, the economy is not looking as good as it did a few weeks ago right now. I mean, some parts of our economy are already in a recession. Others may follow very soon. The stock market has been on a roller coaster ride. And if you look at it over the last month or so, it's down. How worried are you about that when it comes to President Trump's reelection chances and Republicans in Congress as well?
Yeah, it's a reminder that making predictions about the future of American politics is really risky. I mean, I remember after the State of the Union, after the impeachment led to the acquittal, you know, Trump was rising. I think he was even up to 49% job approval in Gallup, his all-time high. It's a reminder that there are a lot of variables, and you know, we can't control all the variables. And obviously, the public, it wants reassurance. They want to see this virus contained. These industries need help, but also a lot of workers out there need help. And so I do think the economy will be stronger in the fall once this is behind us, presuming this is behind us when the summer comes around. But we're in for 4, 6, maybe 8 really tough weeks here. And so I hope the Republicans and Democrats on the Hill can come together and take additional steps, provide catastrophic pay for employees who've been directly affected, look at affecting providing government funding for paid sick leave, which I think in the short term makes sense for people who are having to who are missing paychecks. We'll see whether a payroll tax cut is ultimately going to be part of this or not. Generally, Democrats like payroll tax cuts.
Listen to this. This is President Trump speaking the other day, going after a Democrat, the governor of Washington State, Jay Inslee.
I told Mike not to be complimentary to the governor because that governor is a snake, okay? Inslee.
Governor is a snake. Jamal, when you hear that and Matt's talking about things the president would need Democrats' help for to deal with the coronavirus crisis, do you see, you know, the two sides coming together?
I think people are starting to write Donald Trump out of the script here. Obviously, he has to sign a bill, so the White House needs to be tended to. But this is such a major issue that has to be dealt with. I think Republicans and Democrats are trying to figure out what the right thing is to do on the Hill, and then they'll convince the president to go along with it in whatever way they have to do it. I have to say one thing.
Yep.
There's been talk about an airline bailout. I think if there are any industry bailouts, someone wrote this on Twitter, and I 100% agree, they should not bail out the airlines until the airlines forgive fees for customers that have to change their personal travel habits. This is something we have to pay attention to, how human, real-life citizens are being affected by this crisis, not just the companies that are impacted.
Well, and I was on an airplane this morning, and there were 8 passengers on board. It was almost completely
lots of room to stretch out.
Yeah, that's right. Jamal Simmons, the Democrat, and Matt Mikowiak, the Republican. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
As the White House works on its response to the coronavirus, President Trump and Vice President Pence met with executives from major insurance companies yesterday. Most insurers have said that they will waive all testing fees for the coronavirus. Joining us now is Justine Handelman, who's Senior Vice President of the Office of Policy and Representation at Blue Cross Blue Shield. That's an association of 36 independent companies that provide health insurance for more than 100 million Americans. Justine, welcome. You were in that meeting yesterday. What are your biggest concerns right now about the coronavirus?
Well, I think most important is for people to make sure that they get the testing that they need. And if they're ill, they stay home, but they get the care that they need.
Well, and one of the things that was talked about yesterday is that you and the other insurance providers, according to Vice President Pence, are going to allow people to get tested at no cost to them. Let's listen to the Vice President.
And I'm pleased to report, as you requested, Mr. President, that all the insurance companies here, either today or before today, have agreed to waive all co-pays on coronavirus testing and extend coverage for coronavirus treatment in all of their benefit plans.
So in terms of Blue Cross Blue Shield, does that mean all of the Blue Cross Blue Shield companies across the country?
Yes. In fact, last week we announced that all 36 Blue Cross Blue Shield companies, along with the Blue Cross Blue Shield Federal Employees Program, which covers nearly 6 million federal employees and their families, will be waiving prior authorization and cost sharing for the diagnostic test. We will also be making sure that people have access to the routine prescriptions that they need. In addition, we're expanding telehealth services and nurse clinician hotlines.
And what about patient care? Will members be on the hook for copays and deductibles if they end up in the hospital with coronavirus?
Our members can be assured that these benefits will be covered under their health insurance plan. We are looking to make sure that everyone gets the care that they need. In some cases, there will be the Federal Employees Program is waiving cost sharing for those services, and plans will be working within their benefits. I'd also point out that we're working closely with the government, with the Department of Treasury and IRS, because right now, people that have high deductible health plans that they use in conjunction with their health savings accounts can't access the testing and some of the needed services or the telehealth until they meet their deductible. So we are working closely. We have actually recommended to those departments that they quickly issue guidance that will allow people in high deductible health plans to get the test with no cost sharing and also provide them access to other treatments and telehealth services outside the deductible.
Vice President Pence also said yesterday that there would be no surprise billing. What can you do to ensure that?
Sure. We have been working with lawmakers for months to end surprise bills, and we agree 100% with the Vice President that there should be no surprise bills during this outbreak. We are committed to having people get the care they need when they need it. And during this public health crisis, everyone in the healthcare system needs to do their part. And we believe that everyone in the system will, and that we will act together to ensure patients can access the care they need without the added worry about an unexpected or excessive charge.
That is Justine Handelman, who's Senior Vice President of the Office of Policy and Representation at Blue Cross Blue Shield. She was meeting with the President and Vice President and other insurance industry leaders yesterday. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
As the World Health Organization declares the coronavirus a global pandemic, doctors in Italy are raising alarms about the rapid spread of the disease. The first case there was reported less than 3 weeks ago in the northern part of the country. Now, all of Italy is under lockdown, with more than 10,000 cases and at least 630 deaths. In the northern province of Bergamo, near Milan, doctors at the Papa Giovanni Hospital are overwhelmed with severe cases. And they say what's happening there could happen here in the U.S. Here and Now's Tanya Mosley spoke with two doctors from that hospital, surgeon Richard Nasbro and Stefano Fagioli, the director of the hospital's COVID-19 response. He recently tested positive for the coronavirus and is now in isolation at home. Tanya started by asking him how he was feeling.
Still have a few lines of fever, which is actually going progressively down. Sometimes I'm coughing a little bit, and I'm aching everywhere. So staying in quarantine is something that I need to be, simply because I wouldn't be able to do anything more than that.
Dr. Nasbro, you're also joining us from home, but you are not under quarantine. However, you spend a lot of time at the hospital. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing fine. Our concept at the moment is, as we are all living and working in a very densely inhabited place with a lot of cases, we consider ourselves obviously positive with no symptoms at the moment. So we get on with it. We continue working until eventually we will have some symptoms.
You're working under the assumption that everyone has it.
Well, we must consider this. In this time, obviously, we're in a very advanced phase of contagion. It's easier to consider each other potentially positive and just hope that sometime we will not develop symptoms. In the meantime, trying not to contage anybody else with precautions, therefore.
Yes. Give us a sense of where you are and how bad the outbreak is there.
Well, on Friday, 21st of February, we started the crisis unit. And within basically 10 days from that moment, we had progressively activated four dedicated COVID units of 48 beds each. And as of today, we are on the process of activating the fifth 48-bed unit. So far, most of the doctors are still working. Of course, a number of us are at home in quarantine. Progressively, every day, a few become positive. What we have done, we have identified a few units like infectious disease, pneumology, internal medicine, and gastroenterology. And all the units, the people, the physician of these units are involved in the COVID teams. And all the rest of the hospital, including pathologists or laboratory physician, 25-30% are actively involved in taking care of these patients. So the whole hospital is involved.
Can you give us a sense of how important this hospital is for the region? Are there other medical facilities within the area?
In the area of Bergamo, it's a 1.1 million people area. We have this, which is a 1,000-bed hospital. And then we have two minor local hospitals, 400 and 500 beds. Then we have private institutions which are actively collaborating with us, and they have something like 200 or 100 beds, and they are only fully occupied with COVID people.
Wow. So if all of these hospitals are now inundated with patients for COVID-19, when you run out of room and beds and ventilators, what comes next?
This is the big question. Obviously, it hasn't happened yet. We are making some projections on when and how this could happen, and it is realistically something that could happen. So we're trying to slowly understand when we can free beds in order to make place for the new people, and we are trying to find solutions to increase and transform hubs in complete hospitals dedicated to coronavirus. But this is actually a question I'm sure we have not the answer to yet, but it is a realistic scenario, unfortunately.
I mean, which brings up another question that I think all of us are wondering is, how much can you do for these patients that come in that are exhibiting such severe symptoms? Are you just keeping them comfortable? What's exactly the treatment?
Basically, what we do for them is support oxygen in any possible way. The vast majority of those patients, they can actually stay at home, or they are admitted and they can simply have 2 to 4 liters of oxygen. But there is a number of patients, which is up to 10 to 12% of all the admitted patients, that they eventually need to be intubated in intensive care. And those are the most difficult patients to support, because it's the interstitial pneumonia which is actually making those people unable to breathe regularly. And so you need to support them until their lung restored to a reasonable situation. We still do not have a convincing and final therapy for that. So it's only support.
Mm. One other question I wanted to ask you about all of the hospitals that are really at capacity. I'm thinking about those that have other serious illnesses that aren't emergencies, but cancer patients or patients that need surgery. How are those patients being cared for at this time?
Well, from a surgical perspective, we have to make some choices. We have stopped, not completely, but nearly completely. We are only operating 10% of our capacity. And as I said before, choices are being made to who requires surgery. It's easy, obviously, for emergencies, but obviously we have to treat oncological priorities. So we are continuing to operate, but in a very reduced fashion. We have stopped outpatient clinics, apart from oncological patients and priority emergency patients. But obviously, we are trying to divert all our attention to the main problem, which is obviously accommodating COVID patients. But life around us carries on. That's why we need the support of potentially uncontaminated hubs that can deal with everyday surgery.
Dr. Nasbro, what do Americans need to know or understand? And more importantly, American doctors, do you feel need to understand about COVID-19?
Well, with Professor Fagioli, obviously we have tried to get some preliminary lessons, which we have learned painfully, obviously, at the beginning. And the things we would like to stress are basically the need for everybody, not only doctors, to comply with all the indications the institutions will give us, WHO, to avoid close contact and large gatherings of people. This is something that must happen soon. No panic, obviously, but you must reduce any exposure to movies, schools, university, and meetings in places where contagion will take place. Another message must be that it's not my problem anymore. It's everybody's problem. It mustn't be that people think it's not coming to us. It's everybody potentially ready to be infected.
Stefano, you know, here in the United States, we're all grappling with the question, should we just shut everything down? Should schools close? Should businesses shut down to lessen the possible spread of this coronavirus? Do you think that we should just do that? Should we be shutting down everything so that we're not in this position where just about everyone has it?
It's a very difficult choice, but it's the winning choice, is what we eventually had to do. And of course, all those things, schools, meetings, universities, sports events, theaters, movies, it's part of our life. We don't want to give it away. But in this moment, we should put it on hold for a period, because this is the strongest way to reduce the spread of infection. We don't need to panic, but I think it's going to be wise, whenever there is an outburst of this infection, to avoid gathering of people. And this means shutting down even schools and university. And this is what we had to do.
Stefano Fagioli is the director of the COVID-19 response at the Papa Giovanni Hospital, and surgeon Richard Naspro. Thank you both for joining us. And Stefano, I hope that you get better soon.
Thank you very much. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
This year, the state of Pennsylvania will begin using an algorithm to help judges decide how to sentence offenders, using past data to decide who may commit more crimes. From WHYY's The Pulse, reporter Alan Yu found that's raising a lot of questions about how to make fair decisions.
Lori Dumas has been a judge for more than a decade in family and criminal courts in Philadelphia. She makes important decisions that can change the course of people's lives. She follows the law first, but after that, she has quite a bit of discretion.
You can have one particular set of facts heard by five different judges and get five different results. And that's based on the fact that we are people before we come to the bench.
For example, she is a parent. Her point of view in juvenile court will probably be different than a judge who does not have children.
Our own background, I would say, is probably 95% of the reason why what you may hear in one courtroom is totally different than what you may hear in another.
If she thinks they need more information about a case, she can ask for it. School records, child welfare records, a psychological evaluation. 10 years ago, Pennsylvania's state legislature decided there was a problem with how all this worked.
It was totally arbitrary.
That's Todd Stevens, a Republican state representative and chair of the Pennsylvania Commission on Sentencing.
There was no evidence-based or data-driven objective standard for requesting that additional information. It was done on a whim. Every judge had their own internal set of criteria that they might use.
So in 2010, a state commission got to work on an algorithm, a formula that would allow a computer to predict how likely a person is to commit another crime. It would recommend when judges should get more information about a case. The goal was to make sentencing more consistent, reduce prison populations, lead to less crime. Mark Bergstrom is the executive director of the Commission on Sentencing.
When we started our project, we looked at over 200,000 cases to try to see what factors sort of related to positive and negative outcomes. And that's information that judges didn't have or didn't have in a sort of a structured kind of way.
The formula will look for patterns based on a person's age, gender, the current conviction, prior convictions, and a juvenile record. It cannot take race into account, or a county, which is seen as a proxy for race. The judge will still decide the sentence. But critics say a tool both from criminal justice data would still discriminate against people of color. Pennsylvania is more than 80% white. Almost half the prison population is black. Here's Representative Todd Stevens again.
We took every step that we thought we could to prevent race from being a factor.
That's like saying we're going to take the salt from the sea.
Reuben Jones is an activist and leads campaigns to end mass incarceration in Philadelphia.
We can't pretend that you can't determine a person's race, you know, by other means other than asking what's your address.
He also questions whether data from the past can say something meaningful about someone's future. When he was 22, Jones was convicted of robbery and aggravated assault. That was not his first arrest. he went to prison for 15 years. Since his release, he has gotten a master's degree, become a community leader. He says a risk assessment tool could not have predicted that.
The risk assessment, ideally, I guess, in their minds, will tell them who's going to create a crime in the future. And I'm saying that that's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous assumption to have that a piece of technology can predict human behavior in advance.
The risk assessment depends on one big assumption, that what happened in the past 200,000 cases tells us something about what's going to happen with the next person. He says that is not fair.
When someone comes in front of a judge, forget the algorithms and all those things, talk to them like they're a human being, and see, what does this person in front of me need?
A recent study on Virginia's use of risk assessment algorithms found mixed results, with no decline in recidivism. Michael Kearns is a computer scientist at the University of Pennsylvania. He says using algorithms, or even machine learning to make decisions, forces us to spell out standards for what is fair and what is not.
You should never expect machine learning to do something for free that you didn't explicitly ask it to do for you. And you should also never expect it to avoid behaviors that you wanted to avoid that you didn't tell it explicitly to avoid.
He says if you want an algorithm to really be fair to people of all races, ethnic groups, ages, disability status, gender identity, you have to code for that. The risk assessment algorithm in Pennsylvania will be rolled out this year and evaluated after 12 months to see how it affects sentences. For Here and Now, I'm Alan Yu.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. South Korea has more than 7,000 new coronavirus cases, the fourth highest number in the world, and infections are steadily rising in the capital of Seoul. The latest on COVID-19 around the world and here in the U.S., that's next time on Here and Now.